Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, the stock market over the past week has given me heart palpitations. And it feels like we've just been on this like roller coaster, and there's been dread about inflation, rising rates. And then there's been corporate earnings in the backdrop, which have kind of exceeded expectations. I'm really confused. Can you help me make sense of that? And do you have any guests who could help?
Yeah, well, we have two great guests. It's a perfect 1-2 punch because everything going on in the market now really mostly is a derivative of the Fed and their plan to be more hawkish. There's two ways they're doing that, which we'll go into, but it's not just rate hikes. But the idea of raising interest rates because they're obviously concerned about inflation. And inflation, I think, is actually trumping the idea that the stock market could fall, especially politically. I don't think any of these politicians want to go into midterms or the presidential election with inflation running high. So the Fed looks like they're committed. I've been pretty critical of the Fed always folding like a lawn chair. They get hawkish and they just fold immediately when the stock market goes down 2 points. But they seem pretty persistent. That last press conference that Powell had, I felt he was the strongest he'd been. I'm a casual observer. I'm not an expert. But I, as somebody who's doubted them, I feel like they're have more of a spine now. And so everybody's just repositioning. And they're saying, well, if rates are going to go up a little bit, I've got to figure different things out in my portfolio. So it's hurt growth stocks, helped bank stocks, hurt bonds. And so there's a lot of repositioning. I will say that general mass blob of retail flow is still kind of buying Vanguard. But the outer layers, definitely, you can feel a lot of activity around this, including some selling of stocks and ETFs.
So you'll help us with the ETF side, but who's going to help us with sort of the equity slash economic outlook through all of this?
So Carl Riccadonna, who I've known for a while and now is sort of in my group, he's going to take the Fed part of this. And he's so good at simplifying Fed speak. And I really always go to him when I have a question. And then Gina Martin Adams, who is both of our bosses, she covers the macro outlook. So she's always looking at earnings and the Fed and how the whole thing fits together. So I think she can also talk about how the new environment is affecting her outlook.
All right. So joining us on Trillions, Carl Riccadonna, the chief economist for Bloomberg Intelligence, as well as Gina Martin Adams back on the pod, the chief equity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. This time on Trillions, buckle up for a roller coaster. Carl, Gina, welcome back to Trillions.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
I'm going to start with you, Carl. Is the Fed going to fold like Eric's lawn chair?
The Fed's not going to fold like a lawn chair here, but I don't think they're going to be as aggressive as some of the worst concerns in the marketplace. So as Eric mentioned, in the past, the Fed has been very reactive to a resetting of financial conditions, explicitly sharp declines in the equity markets, because the stock market and the economy are not two independent creatures. What happens in the stock market often has very significant consequences for wealth effects, for households, for confidence effects among companies who maybe pull back on the pace of hiring when equities take a swoon or become much less confident in the economic outlook because equities are in a nosedive. So that does have implications for the commodity for the Fed reaction function. But front and center at the moment is the fact that now the Fed's two main objectives: maximizing the level of employment in the economy and achieving price stability are now both on the same side of the too cold, too hot spectrum. They are both running too hot. So we have the unemployment rate below where the Fed thinks it should settle in the longer run, and obviously inflation far outstripping the Fed's 2% objective. The last reading on the CPI showed a 7% print.
So let's go into what they do. Okay, so we all know that over the past 10 years, they've kept rates low and they've bought assets. I mean, they have a balance sheet that's, I want to say $4 trillion, but you'll correct me in a minute if I'm wrong. Now, explain this idea of what are they doing on the rate side and what are they doing on the balance sheet side going forward?
So what's happening, the Fed uses interest rates, the overnight lending rate, as its primary policy tool. And so as the economy heats up, they raise interest rates to slow things down. What happens in the overnight rate then often gets multiplied out into longer-term lending rates, whether it's your credit card rate, the interest rate on your car loan, your mortgage, or corporate debt lending rates. So what the Fed does then has ripple effects throughout the broader economy. The problem for the Fed, if you keep cutting interest rates, eventually you get to zero. And once you get to zero, then negative interest rates don't really work that well. So that's a policy option the Fed has abandoned. And so what the Fed does then is reach further out into the maturity spectrum or further out on the yield curve by influencing other interest rates. So as we saw after the global financial crisis in 2007 to 2009, the Fed cut rates to zero for the first time and saw the need to do more. And so in doing more, they purchase assets. So they purchase, in this case, treasury securities of varying maturities, so across the yield curve, and also they purchase mortgages. Now, the mortgage is kind of a legacy of the housing bust in 2008-09, and they saw a particular need to influence financial conditions for households. We come out of the 2009 recession and have a very weak economic recovery, so the Fed's very slow to tighten policy by both raising interest rates and also starting to shrink the size of its balance sheet. Sure enough, COVID comes along in 2020. The Fed again has to aggressively cut rates and doesn't have enough room to just achieve their objective through interest rate cuts. So they cut to zero and once again start expanding the balance sheet, in this case, even more aggressively than they did back around the global financial crisis. So they have in 2009, they quadrupled the size of their balance sheet, and now the balance sheet is approaching $9 or $10 trillion. So it's a huge number here for the Fed. And this provided tremendous stimulus during the COVID crisis. We can say, well, the Fed did too much, and in hindsight, that created some inflation problems, but we cannot underestimate what could have potentially transpired had the Fed not acted so aggressively. We saw even the most deep and liquid financial market in the world, the U.S. Treasury market, basically seizing up in March of 2020. And so this was a matter of not only propping up the economy, but also preserving the sanctity, the liquidity of the most deep mark asset classes that are hugely consequential for the global economy and the U.S. economy. So the Fed had to step in a major way. We didn't know exactly how the pandemic would play out. We didn't fully understand what the mortality rate was in the early stages of the pandemic. So the Fed acted in a very big fashion. The other factor they didn't understand was how much fiscal stimulus would be coming through, because the experience after the global financial crisis, Congress was very stingy providing stimulus to the economy. And so the risk was that if we saw a reprise of that, given the political tension in the economy in the country at that time, that maybe there would not be much fiscal support. So the Fed went massively. We got a lot of fiscal stimulus, trillions of fiscal stimulus. So that did very importantly prop up the economy until it could get back onto its own feet. And now the Fed has realized we're at a stage where it is now time. The pandemic is becoming endemic. It's less of a threat to the economy. And so the Fed is pulling back on those levers of accommodation, which means we'll soon be seeing both interest rate increases. And later this year, perhaps much later this year, the Fed will start to gradually shrink its balance sheet.
Gina, Carl successfully has ratcheted up my anxiety. I feel like I'm at the top of that roller coaster now, and which was not what I needed after the last week of watching this market take me on some whiplash. We had you on a few months ago. One of the things that we did spend some time talking about then was inflation. Mm-hmm. It's just become like almost the only thing that the market and the Fed has been centered on since that conversation. So just bring us up to speed on where where you are now, what you feel like that outlook is, and how powerful the Fed is and what the market's going to be doing in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah. Long, lot of questions to answer there. I'll try to get to all of them. First, Joel, I have to say you're going to have to toughen up. You're going to have to get stronger because it's going to be a wild ride in 2022. We have been here before, right? The Fed has attempted to reverse or normalize policy multiple times over the course of the last 10 years. In each case, especially when they stopped inflating the balance sheet, the stock market goes through a pretty rough correction, right? On average, we see the stock market fall somewhere between 15 and 20% in each of those cases that Carl alluded to. So I do think we're going to have to be tougher in 2022. We've gotten very complacent as equity investors over the last 2 years, just really accustomed to constant gains in the equity market. And that's highly unlikely to be the case in 2022. That said, I think a couple of things have changed since the last time I was on. And most of it is really the Fed's interpretation of what's going on. If you recall, when we talked last, we talked about the fact that I believe the economy is on much, much stronger footing than most economists are forecasting. And the demand side of inflation is completely underappreciated. And the Fed really leaned on this idea that inflation was going to be transitory. It would go away because it was all supply driven. And the reality is that household balance sheets are in much, much better condition than they were last cycle. So sort of going on a last cycle playbook for how slow they can move, that's really changed over the course of the last few months, where the Fed is now acknowledging, well, you know, even some of the most esoteric unemployment rate measures that we like to follow to suggest that we're not yet at maximum employment. Well, lo and behold, we're back to where we were in 2019. Right. Retail sales are still on fire for the most part. Inflation is still very strong. There's really very few signs that the economy is even slowing down. So inflation may actually sustain. And I think they finally have capitulated on the idea that, yeah, as Carl mentioned, the pandemic is becoming endemic. It's less of a risk to broader economic growth. And we need to normalize things. So the natural reaction in the stock market is, oh, hey, OK, we thought you were going to be our best buddy and now you're going to leave us be. So valuations are naturally reacting. I think Eric mentioned at the onset that, you know, the market has reacted to inflation. I totally agree. In particular, the market has reacted to how rates are moving with respect to inflation and with respect to what the Fed is going to do specifically. And we see that in our work in the equity market. The stocks with the most sensitivity to rates have dramatically underperformed the stocks with the least sensitivity to rates. And I think that that's going to be the prevailing case for most of 2020, because this is an adjustment process. Now, that said, there is a saving grace here that nobody's talking about, and that is, hey, the economy is still strong. And I think we're going to continue to underappreciate just how strong the economy is, even in the face of Fed tightening, even in the face of potential balance sheet runoff. We probably will continue to underappreciate just how strong that economy is, and that shows up in earnings. So the offset for the market is this sort of pull and push kind of metaphor, where valuations are constantly under some degree of pressure, but earnings do make up some of that difference. And as long as earnings hold in, the longer term uptrend for the stock market probably remains intact.
Let me follow up on this whole idea, because I think people out there hear all the time, oh, higher rates, bad for growth stocks. They're bad for the ARK stocks. Mm-hmm. Clearly, that's happened, right? ARK is down 47% mm-hmm. in the past year, but the S&P is up 20. That is a big spread, although ARK crushed it in 2020. Long story short, just explain why just 25, 50 basis points make that big of a difference for some of these stocks like Zoom, Roku. I mean, these are pretty big companies. It's not like they're like nobody companies who have nothing going on. I guess maybe try to square that.
Yeah. So a couple of things happen, right? If you're a pure fundamentalist, you believe the value of any equity is its discounted future cash flow stream, right? And so if that discount rate is going higher, and your future cash flows are not changing, as the discount rate goes higher, the stocks that had the longest term future cash flow growth are going to be impacted the most. Those are the growth stocks in the market in the most generic sense. At the same time, there is a proven relationship between high volatility stocks and the balance sheet for the Fed. And not very many people can really explain this, but the reality of the situation is every time that balance sheet has accelerated, the highest volatility stocks in the S&P 500, no matter what type of stock they are, have tended to benefit. So what we started to see all the way back in March of last year, actually, is some of these most high volatility stocks in the market started to suss out this idea that the Fed was going to have to tighten policy and liquidity conditions would start to change. And this materially reduced risk tolerance for these type of stocks. Some of them are high growth or high cash flow growth stocks. Some of them have no cash flow at all, so you can't explain it through a traditional fundamental metric. But they are sensitive because they're high vol. And we've really started to see this in some of our factor work over the course of the last 6 months, especially as the factor models that we run were saying, get out of the way of high volatility stocks. Start to move your portfolio to lower volatility stocks. And that is reflecting what's happening with interest rate expectations, but also what's happening with expectations for the balance sheet. If the balance sheet is not going to continue to rise, it will impact the most volatile stocks in the market most. And I think that's what's happened with some of the ARCs and, you know, some of these meme stocks and the like. I mean, you know, as is typically the case, the market really started to suss this out, as I mentioned, almost a full year ago now. But you had some offsets that made us kind of not, you know, maybe when we're looking at the aggregate numbers, the S&P 500 looked great. But if you look at where the returns came from in the S&P 500, it was characteristically very different than the 2020 returns.
Just to paraphrase Gina in very blunt layman's terms, stocks love QE, quantitative easing, the asset purchases from the Fed. If the Fed so much as whispers QE, stocks rally. And when the Fed does the opposite, which is what they've been doing over the course of the last year, when they talk about quantitative tightening, the shrinking of the balance sheet, then the, you know, stocks, as much as they like QE, they despise QT. And the Fed has been murmuring increasingly loudly about quantitative tightening and what that's going to look like over the course of the last several months, especially since the December FOMC meeting. And stocks don't like that, especially the risky stocks don't like that. And that's totally consistent with what we've seen play out in the marketplace.
So, Carl, let's just stick with that for a second. Say I give you the football. You are Jay Powell. When do you next look at the stock market?
Well, you have to continuously watch the stock market and see how it's reacting to what you're doing. Because, again, the stock market is not divorced from the real economy. Everyone says Wall Street is not Main Street, but there are very important linkages here. The stock market is a periscope into future company earnings, into the future health of the economy. So if stocks are tanking, that's giving you a very negative signal on the economy. And that tells you maybe you need to move at a slower pace in terms of tightening policy. Mind you, if we're thinking about Eric Incorporated, let's call it a small business. Eric is producing widgets.
No, it's chairs, lawn chairs.
Lawn chairs. Okay, Eric's lawn chair company. If his business is growing at a 10% pace and the cost of his financing is 1%, what are you going to do, Eric? Grow the business?
Sure.
Sure, keep growing it. Okay, now your business slows down to 8%. Your cost of financing goes up to 4%. Keep growing the business?
A little.
A little, okay. Now the business is growing 4% and your cost of financing is 5%. You're going to grow the business? No,
I'm going to cash out anymore. I'm going to cash out and move the money.
IPO, cash out. Well, you're not going to continue to grow the business. And what's true for Eric's Lawn Chairs Incorporated is also true for a $20 trillion U.S. economy. When the cost of financing approaches the growth rate, then all of a sudden, we're not stepping on the gas pedal anymore. Now we're starting to move towards the brake pedal. So as the Fed lifts rates from zero to maybe 1% at year end, that's really just easing off of the accelerator. It's not stepping on the brake pedal, but it's moving in the direction of the brake pedal. And so that's why Gina can have a very constructive outlook for the economy and for stocks. Just to put those numbers around, instead of Eric's lawn chair business, the U.S. economy, right? Interest rates are zero. or effectively zero. The economy as of the final quarter of 2021 grew at a nominal pace of 12% year on year. So there's a huge gap between 12, the growth rate of the business, and zero, the cost of financing. The Fed is going to start narrowing that gap, and probably nominal GDP slows down considerably to something closer to 5 or 6% by the end of this year. But if the Fed is hiking once per quarter, that puts them at 1%. So you still have a huge interest rate differential. We're not talking until maybe 2024 or beyond, if the Fed continues on this steady pace of tightening, to really move that interest rate differential down to what we would call a neutral pace. The Fed is giving it a very aggressive steroid to the economy and will continue to do so, albeit in slightly smaller doses going forward.
I would just add one thing, because I think that was a great explanation surrounding the cost of financing. I would say when we look at corporate balance sheets, the thing that also is completely underappreciated is that cost of financing is significantly lower than you might observe when you're looking at even spreads because of the degree to which companies have built up cash stores. And it's very similar with households, where we are substantially less dependent on financing to grow. Especially relative to the last cycle, where corporate balance sheets and household balance sheets were in tremendous disrepair following the great financial crisis. They're on significantly sounder footing. And, you know, the perfect example of this is Microsoft wants to grow. They don't need to go issue debt to even buy a company as large as Activision, which is a huge testament to just how much insane amount of cash is just sitting on balance sheets. And it's the same across most of the S&P 500, where corporate cash is still sitting near an all-time high, even though we're this far into recovery. And it's quite phenomenal, right? Is this companies just haven't spent a ton yet on anything. And even though they've been able to tap the bond markets for the last couple of years, they have stored up a lot of capability of keeping this cycle going for longer than many people anticipate, even if the Fed is tight.
And I should just add to what Gina's saying, what she's seeing at the company level is also true at the household level. Households stockpiled cash during the pandemic. They got rebate checks from the government. They didn't have the opportunity to spend money in many cases. And a lot of households were significantly invested in the markets. And so they saw their wealth increase on that front as well. So there's a mountain of savings that's in the trillions of dollars that households are sitting on, which is why they can weather the storm of slightly higher inflation and higher interest rates as well.
But it's going to be a bumpy little ride here, Eric, for all of them. And I'm curious, like, just as flows go, just something I know you watch closely all the time, what's it been like of late? Where have people gotten out of? I saw that SPY had a massive outflow. What other kind of things have caught your eye, and bring it back to the world of ETFs for us?
Yeah, sure. And I think I'll pivot to a question for Gina, which is, The main Vanguard investor is just totally oblivious. They're just investing. Vanguard's taken in a $21 billion. That's just like nothing's happening. Schwab is doing well too. So if you're like a passive Bogolin type investor, none of this really bothers you. That said, there's the trading crowd and people, institutions who are repositioning on the fringes especially. So for example, we're seeing a lot of money go into financial ETFs. Obviously, rates go up, they can lend, get a higher rate, or they can get more, their interest rates are good for them. We've also seen gold get a bid because I think there's some nerves on like, hey, I should be more diversified because my 60 and my 40 is going down. And we've seen value ETFs and energy. I'd put energy and value together almost because they're beat up for so long. So there's a bit of a repositioning and that's where it's happening. And the other thing that's the big loser this year, besides the Qs, which is seeing outflows, is bonds. If you look at the outflow list, it's basically, it's a who's who of all the bond ETFs, TLT, HYG, even the TIP ETFs, TIPS ETFs, LQD, IEF, JNK. It's basically treasuries, mortgages, because if rates go up, all those current bonds are just worthless because you can get more with the new rate. So what the Fed is doing clearly is going to impact the bond market. And there's been this huge monster bull market for like 20 years. And like, I guess I would throw it to Gina. I just went over a lot, but is the bond market going to have real problems? And is that going to spill over into the stock market?
You know, I think that we certainly are on the precipice of a longer term shift in rates. And I base that opinion based simply on my views of the economy. I just think the economy is in a completely different condition than it was for the bulk of the last 10 years. I also think the inflationary scenario is very different, in part as a result of that, but other longer term structural factors as well. And the result of that is we are very unlikely to see rates as low as we did for much of the last 10 years, or the first, call it 10 years of this bull market in stocks. So the value of your future cash flows, you know, is naturally going to adjust to rates moving higher. But again, the offset there is that cash flow growth should also be stronger. And the thing that we might all be underappreciating is if bonds move from 30-year bull market to bear market, or even just moving sideways and then slightly bear market, what we could be underappreciating is just the amount of capital that comes out of bonds and goes into stocks. And that, I think, is much more difficult to model. It's been one of the anomalies of the first 10 years of this cycle were not about investors putting more money to work in stocks. We know that for sure. We know that investors, broadly household ownership of equities, merely went up because market value went up. On net, they didn't add anything to their equity portfolio, which is completely anomalous historically. You don't see a 10-year economic recovery in which investors don't add any more capital to the equity market on net. It's just wildly strange. I think starting in 2020, probably extending into 2021, and I do think moving into 2022 and beyond, we're going to continue to see this great rotation. Really, in 2020, we started to see the first signs that equity and that investors are interested in stocks again, with flows coming back to the market, longer term flows moving back into stocks. We started to see IPO issuance again in 2020 and 2021. These are things that I didn't talk about for 10 years because they just weren't supports to the stock market. Instead, the stock market went up because the supply of equities went down, not because demand for equities went higher. So I think that we are seeing a little bit more exuberance in the stock market develop simply because the bond market is in disrepair. There will be offsets. And in periods of time in which rates are dominating attention and moving in a spiking fashion, it does create volatility for the stock market. But longer term, you know, you just model what happened in the 1950s and 60s. The stock market went through a 20-year bull market as rates were rising. This is certainly possible to have rates rise and the stock market rise at the same time. But you do have to have very strong growth, and you have to have somewhat contained inflation before there's a switch that gets flipped.
Okay, so that whole idea of bonds and stocks, and this is what most people have in their retirement portfolio. This brings me to a theory I want to throw at Carl. I threw it at Gina last time she was on.
Carl, he's sitting in a lawn chair right now.
Yeah, this is kind of why the lawn chair thing comes up with me. I have this thing called the Boomerati theory, which is that, you know how like Jay Powell's a boomer, Trump was a boomer. Isn't it? First of all, it's interesting that Trump and Biden kept the same Fed chair. They would agree on nothing. Two things they agree on. They like Powell and they hate Bitcoin, right? There's a boomer thing. It transcends politics. They have all the money. If you look at the stock and bond market over the years, it's become America's retirement fund. So all these boomers, which they own about like 70% of the stock market, it's their money. And they're at all the levers of power. So is there possibly, subconsciously or consciously, going to always be a Fed put, because this is literally America's retirement money? We cannot let the stock and bond market go down that much.
I would say that this is not, first of all, as you're sitting in your lawn chair, I suggest you take off the tinfoil hat, or at least loosen it around the
edges. Put the Twitter down.
So in some capacity, we could view this through the eyes of the boomers preserving their wealth and some conspiracy against the millennials and their disruptions and whatnot. Although the millennials are poised for the largest transfer of wealth in the history of humankind as we look, you know, 20 years down the road and whatnot. However, again, this preservation of the stock market or the Fed put. So the Fed is not just acting to prop up assets. The Fed is looking at looking to achieve successful economic stewardship. Now, if they successfully achieve that goal of price stability and maximum employment, then they are creating the type of economy that Gina is describing, where you have controlled inflation pressures and healthy growth in the economy, and that should be favorable for the equity market. So, you know, it's more about the economic stewardship question, which the side effect of that is a healthy stock market than some sort of nefarious plot for some generation to hoard the wealth, as you say. And, you know, as Gina described it, as I think she used the expression, the great rotation that we're seeing playing out over the next couple of years, I think of it in macro terms as the great competition, right? And the competition is with, let's say, a two-year government yield. Right. During the crisis, 2-year government government notes were yielding about 0.1%. They are now yielding a full percentage point higher, about 1.1%. And that will only go up as the Fed formalizes its plans to continue raising rates. If the Fed is raising the overnight rate, 2-year yields are going to go up as well. So now stocks, whether it's Cathie Wood's ARK or a dividend paying, equity aristocrat, they're not competing against 0.1% rate of return. They're now competing against a 1.1% yield on a 2-year government security. So that competition is heating up, and that means you're less happy holding those longer maturity assets like a 10-year yield or a 30-year bond, for instance, or some of the corporates, very highly rated corporates that are not giving you much return. The competition is heating up, and so now there's more of that rotation into higher yielding equities, for instance, which is another way of framing that growth versus value debate.
Okay, as we start to bring this roller coaster ride to an end, Carl, Gina, I'm going to ask you a question, and it's a free for all. You can do whatever you want with it. Eric knows a lot about ETFs. We've talked a lot about the economy, about the Fed, about equities. What ETF question would you like to ask, Eric? Carl, you go first.
Okay. Well, first, before I ask that question, I'm just going to go back to Joel's roller coaster analogy, because Gina and I have done our best here to kind of signal that the roller coaster, just because it goes up the steep hill, doesn't mean there's a scary descent thereafter. And we both have a relatively constructive outlook where the Fed can move towards the exit and the economy performs soundly. And that's my baseline scenario. I believe it's Gina's baseline scenario as well. That doesn't mean this can't be a scary or bumpy roller coaster ride, because this is a path fraught with danger, right? If the Fed is too worried over the inflation outlook, tightens too aggressively, unwinds the balance sheet, which is, again, a tool we've only used once before, so we're not entirely sure of what the potency of that tool is. So if we take the unknown medicine and take too high of a dosage, you can have some real problems here. And so it can certainly be a bumpy ride, and the risk is the Fed could move too slowly and inflation gets out of control. I think the bigger concern is that the Fed could potentially panic, move too aggressively, and nudge the economy into a downturn, into a recession, which then you're back to applying all of this aggressive medication to try to re-stimulate growth. So there's certainly a potentially exciting roller coaster ride ahead, Joel, as you according to your analogy. But I would be interested in asking Eric about the passive. Is passive investing, passive versus active, is that, how confident are you that that trend continues? Because if you're a passive investor and you're in the type of economic cycle we saw over the past couple of years, Fed delivers massive, stimulus to the economy. So with the rising tide's going to lift all ships, it's a great environment to be passive. I would, just to play devil's advocate, wonder if we're not heading into the stock picker's paradise now, where we've had a big rise in the equity markets, but now the differentiation starts to occur as the tide, as Warren Buffett says, as the tide starts to roll out, we find out who's wearing a bathing suit and who's not. Aren't we heading into that realm right now, Eric, where now the active investors are going to really be able to differentiate themselves as it becomes a stock picker's market? And therefore, it will be less of a pro-ETF or at least a pro-passive environment going forward.
Well, yeah, good. You're good to separate ETF and passive, because our big outlook theme this year is that ETFs have transcended the passive label. I mean, it's a big tent. And more they're becoming active, and people use them actively. So one thing I would say is, we just went over how flows are going into financials and value ETFs. So people are actively using passive ETFs to reposition, just like you're saying. Relative to the stock picker problem is this. A stock picker, you know, if you're doing deep value stock picking, I think you have a bright future. If you're doing like closet indexing stock picking, like the Fidelity Magellan, which holds mostly S&P and tilts a little, your goose is cooked. You'll never get money again, because nobody is going to sell a 3 basis point Vanguard fund and buy you for 80 basis points when you're mostly the Vanguard fund, and I can't even guarantee you'll outperform. In fact, the odds are you won't. Also, in past downturns, active has only outperformed at the same 33%, 35% rate as when it's good. Look, cheap beta is just a hell of a drug. People are just not going to sell a 3 basis point Vanguard fund. My theory is, if active got cheaper, if Fidelity started passing on economies of scale and got to 20 bips, 15 bips, then their little bets around the S&P could actually be worth it. But at 80, I just don't think it stops anything. I think what you will see, though, is more and more people use ETFs actively. And so you'll see flows into financials, deep value, and that kind of thing. But as we can see, Vanguard is taking in money like nobody's business. And also, the Vanguard type investor, the kind of person who goes to Vanguard, typically is pretty aware that you own everything. So whether value's in play or growth's in play or energy stocks are a hit, it's FOMO proof. You already own it. I don't really care. I'll just, you know, what am I going to do? Replace this with like the hot stock picker of that year? And then probably underperform in the year after. Most of them have just come to the conclusion there's no better deal. That's my opinion on that.
Gina.
Do I get to ask my question now? So
yeah, I was going to say, you're Eric's boss. So I'm really interested. And it can be drug related. It could be lawn chair related or ETF related. Your call.
So my question really is around the non-passive portion of ETFs. And we have seen some active conversions. We've obviously seen thematic investing really just take off over the course of the last few years. And your team, Eric, has done some insane work on themes and the sort of the themes that are driving stocks. So my question for you is, who's the next ARK? If ARK is over, if we can just assume that ARK is over for now, where are we going to see the next big theme? What's the next big theme that's going to drive stocks, and what should we be on guard for?
Yeah, this is really a fascinating question, because we wrote a note that said a deep value ETF could be the next Cathie Wood, because it's not about growth. It's really about concentration. We think that if most people's core of their portfolio is now in dirt cheap beta, and they're happy with that, they're not going to touch it, they're going to let the paint dry for 20 years, they are looking for things to put on the outside, like hot sauce. So Cathie was perfectly positioned for a growth wave hot sauce. What comes next? And theme ETFs, like cybersecurity and cryptocurrency ETFs. So I think you could see a theme start to repackage value stocks in fun, clever ways. Like maybe they'll come out with a stuff you really effing ETF, which is basically just like consumer staples. Because themes have really done a good job of stealing thunder from sectors and from styles and from factors by sort of making it easy, you know, more fun and easy to understand, like the work from home ETF. That's just two sectors put together. It's not like rocket science, but the labeling is really powerful. And so we also think that, so I think you'll find some themes that tap into like maybe the staples or value stocks, and maybe a deep value ETF, because we did see that the ones that have the most concentration pop the most in Q1, and they were doubling and tripling the Vanguard Value ETF, which is very weighted down with big cap names. So again, our big theme is, look, we always say you have to, there's the three C's to ETF success. You got to be cheap, you got to be creative or concentrated, or Cabernet, which is you got to sort of like wine and dine advisors. But I'll move that lane aside. But clearly, shiny objects aren't limited to growth. They can be value. They can be energy. You know, there's an ETF called the fracking ETF. I mean, there's certain ways you can sort of play with the energy, maybe like old guy, old school energy or something, and maybe try to make oil producers interesting again because they're doing so well. So that's where I think you'll see it. But a lot of those flows are more on the fringe, but they're going to keep coming. I mean, we just saw an ETF for airline, cruises, and hotels, which is essentially like the reopening trade.
Joel, can I get a second question?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Genie. That's like asking the genie for another three wishes. I want to ask Eric if you think that this kind of deep value investment can outperform something like tech disruption, which is what ARK was all about, over a longer period of time. And I would, you know, as a skeptic, I would say, no, it couldn't. Tech is going to tech disruption is going to have a higher sustained growth rate over the long run than deep value, which may in the short run have a rebound and maybe outpace tech, but not over the longer run.
Well, it all moves in waves. You know, I have a line in my new book coming out about Bogle, because he launched the value ETF and the growth ETF way back in the 90s. He actually pioneered style indexing. And he said, I thought you'd buy the growth ETF when you're young, and then you'd transfer to the value. And you find out people tried to trade it, and they ended up doing worse than just owning the S&P. And if you track growth and value over a long period of time, they sort of end up at the same spot. So I cite that line from Almost Famous, when Lester Bangs tells the high school reporter, oh, don't worry, you'll meet them all again in the long road to the middle. So I do think if you time it right, you can make a lot of money. But in the 2000s, small cap value, and Gina, I think, will attest to this, she probably has better numbers than I do. In 2000 to 2010, which is a whole decade, small value crushed the S&P, which was, I think, flat. And small value was up a lot. And that was during a huge tech renaissance, right? You had a lot of, the internet was just kind of like exploding. So I would say it's totally possible that there's a complete regime change. And it has to be like a psychological thing where people are just like, we were too crazy with the computers. We really want to get back to basics. I don't know. Like, there's a psychological thing, and it all of a sudden becomes, it just seems so silly to go so far into the tech. And it seems more, I guess, it just seems right to go into staples and energy for some reason. I don't know if Gina has a comment on that, but I don't know if that psychological thing will ever, to Carl's point, our culture is so tech oriented. Could someone ever get out of that psychological mindset that tech is the future?
Well, I think we're watching it happen to some degree, and we're watching it happen in energy stocks and technology related energy stocks. I mean, the perfect example, the S&P 500 is even thinking about reconstituting indices because they don't know what to do with all these techie energy companies, right? And we're in the midst of, you know, trying to tackle things like climate change and, you know, massive energy consumption problems that are resulting in energy stocks materially outperforming. I mean, I don't know how many people pay attention to this, but energy stocks were up 20% in January while the market crashed. And it's been our big call for the last year and a half that longer term, as long as inflation is at a much stronger pace, that's the key. And if, you know, commodity prices are contributing to that inflation, then it's even a bigger key that energy stocks will outperform. And if you look back in history, growth doesn't always outperform. Value usually outperforms when growth, economic growth is faster, because value stocks tend to leverage that near-term economic growth outlook better, right? Tech has longer dated cash flows. Value stocks get the immediate cash flow growth when the economy is running at a faster pace. So I completely agree that I think it's a great call to be in small cap value. I think value already is showing signs of topping out or beating out growth stocks and will continue to beat out growth stocks. Our favorite sector is still energy, followed very closely by financials. And I don't see that changing. And what will make that chained, what will make that endure is the inflation outlook. If you think inflation is going to settle this cycle at a pace above 3%, you have to be in value over growth. If you think inflation is going to revert back to the slow inflation environment that we saw in the last cycle, then you want, you know, you want to move back toward the growth sensitive stocks in the market.
Carl, we have a question that we ask everybody on Trillions, first time on, so you're going to get it. What's your favorite ETF ticker?
Oh my goodness. My favorite ETF ticker.
Don't worry, Carl. I bobble this question every time.
Yeah, you know,
you're talking about ETF nerds.
I'm going to go with like a kind of, you know, passive Vanguard, nice. You know, type of all cap kind of rising tide continues to lift all boats. Since we're allowed to bobble the answer here, I'm going to go into my ETF pick list. I'm going to go with VIG, the Vanguard Dividend Appreciation ETF. And this factors back into this whole the great competition thesis, which I mentioned earlier in our discussion, because dividend appreciation is, you know, I think going to be so fundamentally important to stock valuations as we move into a higher inflation and higher interest rate regime for the foreseeable future.
You bobbled it, recovered the fumble, and then like took off for a touchdown.
Yeah, and that, also that's the first person who picked VIG. You're original.
All right, we'll end it there. Gina Martin Adams, Carl Wickedana, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.